show!
You have all made it through the dance. You have all made it.
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 82. I'm your host, John X. Thank you for joining us. Glad to have you back once again. Denver Film Festival week. That's right, 4 of 5. We are nearing the end, and part of me is sad as a result of that because this has been great. I loved going to the Denver Film Festival. I love talking to artists. And the two guys on this week's show, they're a couple of unusual cats. I'm comfortable saying that. I'm comfortable with them hearing it. I think they know that. And I think they know that because of the films that they make. So who am I talking to this week? It is Mike Ott and Nate Silver. And it's not that Nate Silver. It's not the analyst who correctly predicted who was going to be president in 2012 and got his own site as a result of that. Different Nate Silver. Filmmaker Nate Silver. And in my estimation, the superior Nate Silver, because this Nate Silver sat down and talked with me for like an hour. And he was an awesome dude. He sat in traffic for like 2 hours coming straight from the airport, sat down with me, and gave me great insight. I love talking to him. I love talking to Mike Ott. One of the things that we talked about was a project that they're working on together. It's called Untitled Denver Project, scheduled for release sometime next year. And they didn't tell me a hell of a lot about it. They kind of let slip some of the details at the end. I don't hang a lantern on that or anything, but it's in there if you're paying attention. But they're very sort of hush-hush about it. And I sort of understood why as we went further down the line in this conversation. Now, Mike's film that was at the Denver Film Festival was a short. It was called Lancaster, California. Spotlighted a guy named Corey. I saw it. It's beautiful. It's gorgeously shot. It's very intimate. I liken it to getting to look through a keyhole at a conversation and a person where I feel like I'm getting access where I might, maybe shouldn't. And that's kind of a cool feeling. That's one of the things that film does. Similarly, Nate Silver's project is called Stinking Heaven, and it's a very challenging film. One of the reviews I read called it a lo-fi entry into the found footage genre. So it's about a house with recovering addicts. Takes place in 1990, and it unfolds over kind of a short period of time, and in a lot of ways, very difficult film to watch. Made me uncomfortable. And you know what? I'm going to link to a couple of reviews on the blog piece. So if you want to learn more about both these films, about both these guys, go to johnofalltrades.us. That's J-O-N of all trades.us. And it'll provide some additional color about both these filmmakers. Both very passionate guys, and it's fun to talk to them. One of the best parts of the conversation here is, how do you define success? And I would argue it's not defined by the traditional markers that you think of when you go, oh, is my film successful or not? Their answers are very interesting, very thoughtful. Additionally, they're both very candid about some of the things that annoy them and piss them off about doing the festival circuit. And when you listen to them, you go, oh my God, yeah, that would be annoying. I do PR professionally for a living, as any regular listener of this podcast knows. And some of the challenges that they face are similar to the ones that I face. So it was great talking to them. I appreciated their candor. I appreciated their no bullshit sort of sensibility. This was just enormous fun. And at some point in the middle of this podcast, it's kind of towards the end, we're ordering more drinks. The Neil, who is the PR rep, just came by and they asked if they could get another round of drinks, and I joined in. So I go, hell yeah, bring me a whiskey. And I'd just like to plug that the Denver Film Festival was featuring Fireside Bourbon from Mile High Spirits, which, love that bourbon. I think it's terrific tasting. Big fan of it. Now, the reason I plug that is because these guys don't plug anything. It comes to the end of the show, and I go, what do you guys want to plug? And they go, nothing, really. If you see us out in the city, buy us a drink. Okay, no problem. Done. But I plug their work for them. You can find it on the blog, like I said, johnofalltrades.us. One plug for me. And that goes to 4 Degrees. This is episode 82. 4 Degrees has been with us since the very beginning. They helped build the site. They helped design it. They provide us technical support. They ensure that all of our episodes appear on iTunes. That's 82 episodes, all of them available on iTunes. And they make sure everything is optimized. Now, that's one part of what they do, which is enormously valuable for me personally. The other part of their business, they are an online marketing an advertising firm. So if you are looking to target Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or wherever. These guys can design a campaign for you that reaches the consumer that most needs to hear your message. Now, whether that's a candidate, whether that's a product, whether that's a service, whether that's something that you just want other people to see, 4Degrees will sit down with you and go, okay, what do you want to do? How do you hope to achieve it? All right, now let's design a plan and let's implement it. So, and they will do it for a cost that is better than you are probably paying right now. So check them out. 4Degrees, the number 4, DEGRE.ES. Let's get right to it. This is our fourth episode here from the Denver Film Festival. It features Mike Ott and Nate Silver, a couple of great guys, a couple of very talented filmmakers. And the episode starts right now.
Whiskey.
Yeah?
Whiskey. No, coffee.
Well, it could be both.
It's too early to...
It's too early?
Well,
it's 7.
It's nighttime. It's noon somewhere.
That's about time, yeah.
So, and what about you, Nathan?
Hello.
What do you got?
I got wine. Got some white wine.
And how is it? Light and woody?
Yeah. It's a little too sweet for my taste. My taste buds. I like it to be like the dry, sour shit.
I kind of do too. I like the I like it when it's a little crisper, little citrusy.
Yeah,
like a
tangy. There's a tangy,
right? Like a Sauv Blanc.
Yes, exactly. Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, which is lovely, right? Mm-hmm. So sitting here with Nathan Silver and Mike Ott, two directors. Actually, you're working together on Untitled Denver Project. Is that right?
That's right.
We are.
Yeah.
And you both have films appearing at the Denver Film Festival.
Yeah.
Mike, yours is called Lancaster, California.
It is.
And it's a short.
It's a short.
Right? Yeah. And then Nathan, yours is feature length.
Yep.
And so it's called Stinking Heaven, right?
Yep.
So first of all, the thing I'm interested in, because we're here in Denver, what can you guys tell me about Untitled Denver Project?
Well, basically, it all came about last year at last year's festival. Mike and I were having some drinks up here at this lounge, and Arthur Martinez approached Mike and said that he wanted to make a movie that he wanted to be in a movie that Mike would direct.
Nice.
And then Mike brought me over and said, only if I was involved.
And we went, instead of making a short, we wanted to make a feature. And then there was a lot of negotiating with Arthur to convince him to do it. And it's crazy. I mean, it was almost a year ago that we came up with the idea. Now it's been shot, it's edited, and we're almost
picture
finished.
Locked. Yeah. 2 days ago.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about the film?
Nothing. I mean, nothing? We don't even know what the film is. It's a... It's total chaos.
Really?
Yeah.
But you said it's locked and put
in. Okay. Yeah. It's feature length. We can tell you that. Yeah.
Okay. You can see where I'd be confused.
It's all shot in Denver. We can tell you that. Mostly everyone from Denver, like actors and performers and whatnot. I don't know. It's like a half fiction, nonfiction, semi fiction
mutant
of filmmaking. Yeah.
And when's it targeted to come out?
It'll come out sometime next year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, kind of secretive about this project.
Well, it's like, I mean, if you see the film, you understand it's a hard film to kind of describe exactly what it is.
Okay.
It's not really like a Mr. A goes to spot B and, you know.
It focuses primarily on Arthur, though.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll look forward to it. And so what you have here, though, Mike, let's start with you. Let's talk a little bit about Lancaster, California.
Yeah.
From what I understand, it's a short, but it's part of a larger feature. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm doing a feature called California Dreams, which is kind of this like sectional piece on different people in like outside of LA who want to be part of Hollywood but can't for whatever reason.
And Lancaster focuses on Corey.
On Corey, yeah.
Right. For people who have never seen it, what would you tell them about it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's another weird movie to describe. It's just a kind of a portrait on Corey, where he's from, and kind of his struggles with love and relationships and sex. And I mean, it's a weird little film. You saw
The bulk of it is this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that struck me was when I was watching it, and I got this sense from your film too, Nathan, is I felt like there was like a voyeuristic quality to it, where I felt like I was getting to peer through a keyhole where maybe I wasn't supposed to, you know, because it's a very intimate conversation between these two guys. And one thing that I kind of like and that's challenging about both your films is you're asking viewers to jump into the deep end sort of right away. Mm. Because we don't know. I didn't even know who the second guy was.
Sure.
I don't know what his relationship is. I don't know what their relationship is. You get a sense from it from the dialogue. But when you're making a short film like that and you have sort of some undefined relationships, Is that challenging for audiences? What kind of feedback have you gotten?
I mean, it might be. I think Nathan and I both are kind of interested in a certain kind of filmmaking. Like, I mean, we could have that kind of movie where we explain who everyone is and you have all this exposition. But to me, and I think to Nate, like, it's just kind of super boring. And I think it's okay not to answer every question and let everyone figure everything out.
Right.
I mean, I think you get once you come in that these two guys know each other. It doesn't matter how. And ultimately, you know, it's kind of this little vignette on Corey and the stories that he tells that's important that I think people connect with.
It was funny to me because there's like little interludes of metal. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about that because it was almost like a non sequitur to me. Does that fit into the larger narrative?
I think so. I mean, I was trying to break it up. And also, Corey has like the worst taste in music. He likes like the worst, like kind of rap metal and just like
what,
bad.
Like butt rock?
Yeah, no, just like really current kind of stuff that's terrible. And so that, I mean, I would imagine that was a song that he would listen to, so that's why I put it in there.
Oh,
and some of the other sections were using like the music that the characters would listen to.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that, I mean, that piece of insight I think is really good. Building on something you said, sometimes not explaining adds intrigue to a film. I think about a movie like Halloween, mm-hmm. where, and then Rob Zombie remade it and gave Michael Myers like this origin story. And to me, it made him less scary, and it made him a little bit more sympathetic, whereas the first Halloween I really liked because it's like he's just this terrifying monster that sort of exists. I don't need to know that he was left in the dumpster as a baby.
Oh, that's, I haven't seen the Rob Zombie one, but that's what happened.
I spoiled the beginning.
Okay. Well, so
I think you'll survive that.
Okay, yeah.
But so, yeah, at the beginning, it shows Michael Myers like in this dumpster as a baby, which is a disturbing image and perfect for a horror movie, right?
Yeah.
But you know, you go, oh, okay, so he's all fucked up because he's had a bad childhood right from the get-go. And I go, that makes him less interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know. Are you inclined to agree with that analysis?
Well, I mean, I haven't seen either Halloween.
Oh, so interesting. All right.
I understand what you're getting at. But I mean, like, if you take Singing Heaven, for instance, like, I think you finally understand what the movie's about, like, 20 minutes in when a new character enters the commune and all the rules are explained to her. You understand what the rule, like, you're just thrown into the midst of this bizarre world and you have to make do with the little clues I give. And there are a lot of characters and there's a lot of chatter going on at all times. I mean, it's the chaos of life. I mean, you walk down the street, or it's the chaos of my life because I live in New York.
Sure.
I walk down the street and I'm trying to make sense of the world at every, you know, footstep.
Yeah. It's like vignettes in your life. All of a sudden you'll get thoroughly engrossed in someone talking on the subway.
Yeah.
And you'll go, wow. And you get just this brief little snapshot of their lives, which is kind of, I mean, that's kind of what your film is, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, the way Mike and I made the movie over the summer, we shot it, basically we scheduled it in such a way where like half the day we scheduled scenes we knew we needed for the movie for there to be a story. And then we would fill the rest of the day with stuff we made up on the spot, basically.
Yeah.
And we wanted to just capture what was going on. I think we're like making documentaries of fictional worlds, and that's what fascinates us. So,
yeah.
Wow, that's really cool. Documentaries of fictional worlds. And I would say one of the reviews I read of Stinking Heaven likened it to a lo-fi entry into the found footage genre.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that analysis?
Well, we shot it on Betacam. It's not Betacam. It's an old broadcast camera. So, I mean, it's supposed to look like it's of, you know, of, it's from the late 80s, early 90s.
It's period appropriate.
Period appropriate.
Right.
But I like that idea. Like I said, someone said it looked like it was left in like a video cassette that was left in a dumpster or something. I like that. That's great. I mean, I don't put any, I don't know, I can't attach any adjectives to the movies I make. I just make these movies. So if people want to, you know, call it, or any genre even. I mean, like, if Mike and I are to describe the Denver movie, I mean, I don't know if it's a documentary or not. I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
It becomes problematic when you just,
yeah,
you basically take reality and start mixing in all of these fictional aspects. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, well, it's kind of strange because the aesthetic that you capture in this film, just it, for whatever reason, it screams authenticity, right? Like, you get into this world and you go, oh man, so like I'm in here, and you feel it from the aesthetic. It feels like one of the other characters is filming what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
So that's an intentional choice.
Absolutely. The weird music that comes in.
Yeah.
I mean, it starts to take over any naturalism that's there. It starts to break it down and destroy it.
No,
because there are all these expressionistic aspects that I threw in there.
Right. No, I
fuck with the viewers.
and it works because watching your film, you bill it as a black as tar comedy.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, I didn't laugh all that much.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're not supposed to laugh necessarily at a black comedy.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, have you ever read the short story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, by Flannery O'Connor?
No.
Okay. It's super dark comedy, too.
Yep.
And that, it's one of my favorite stories. So I couldn't help but think of that, because you have characters almost trapped by the inherentness of themselves. And they can't fully escape that.
Yeah, we can't escape our flaws.
Right. As far as the aesthetic that you chose, Mike, when you made Lancaster, does the rest of California Dreams sort of follow that same sort of feel?
I think so. I mean, part of California Dreams is, you know, letting these people who have wanted to be in Hollywood have their moment in cinema. So it's shot very like cinematic.
Yeah.
Like everything looks very epic, even though it's like someone just drinking a cup of coffee, like it's slow motion and, you know,
right.
It's shot like lit very beautiful, just so it's like they can for once be like a character in their own film.
Well, I think about the closing shot of Lancaster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's gorgeous. Yeah. And a road is, I mean, that's iconic in terms of cinema.
Yeah.
One thing I was curious about Nate is I read that you replicated the living conditions.
I mean, people have just written about that because of the fact that the actors and I lived in that house because we didn't want to commute back to New York every day.
Okay.
It wasn't like I was, but then, you know, you utilize that and exploit that fact. And because we were living in that house, it started to, you know, wear on everyone. I mean, it's like, it's basically one of the actors, and also he's an associate producer on the movie. It's his great aunt's house, and she'd passed away a few months prior to the shoot. It feels like death there, you know. So we're like living in death in this place, and I mean, it's just just dust everywhere, and it was disgusting. But it's kind of also it caused the movie to take a certain direction.
Did you know when you started it how it was going to end up?
No, the last shot in the movie. Sorry, the thing that we wrote as the ending is actually the first shot in the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So
wow,
that's how things...
Holy shit, that was written as the ending?
Yep.
And obviously, I don't want to give that away.
Yeah.
Don't give away the beginning.
Yeah, don't give away the beginning. That's.
But knowing it's the ending, like, if you watch it and then know that fact, I think that brings a lot to it. You know, that's such a cool, like, footnote to know.
Yeah, but then it didn't work as the ending, so we brought it to the beginning in order to give some context to the characters. We made it the past instead of the future.
And you know what? I would say it works better as the beginning.
Yeah.
Than it would as the ending.
Yep.
Wow. One of the other reviews I read of it said that it's sort of, because of the tension involved in this movie, it walks right up to the edge of being classified as horror.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring true to you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't watch horror movies, but I think my experience of life is that I'm always anxious, and life is full of horrors. It, you know, even when you're completely comfortable and having a grand time at a festival, I'm always you know, you're anxious, and I mean, that's just part of life. Maybe that's just my vision of life.
No, hell is other people, as you noted, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a quote of my life.
As someone who, that's something I identify with, because as someone who has suffered from anxiety my entire life and been stricken with panic attacks from time to time, I felt very claustrophobic in this movie. By design?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I wanted to get out of this house
almost
the entire time. So when I read the horror thing that someone else pointed out to me, I go, yeah, okay, I get that a little bit. But the thing is, there's nothing overtly sort of macabre. Or, you know, there's no, like, jump scares, there's no startles or anything. It's just sort of a feeling that if you have it, you go, oh, my God.
Yeah, and that's how I experience life, so I'm glad to put it in my movies.
You raised money for this film on Kickstarter, right?
Yeah, we raised most of the money on Kickstarter, and the rest was financiers who came on board.
Okay. And what was it like doing a Kickstarter campaign?
It's hell. I mean,
it's the worst.
Yeah, Mike's done one.
You've done one too?
Have you done more than one?
I just did one, yeah. But
I've done
it was
two.
The worst. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is it might be the only place to get money, because movies, it's hard to make money off of these movies and to get money back to your investors, but it's a wearing experience, and I don't know. It takes months out of your life.
Explain that. I've never done a Kickstarter, and for anyone who hasn't.
Because your knees get bloody from begging so much. You beg everyone you know.
It's embarrassing. It's like humbling. You have like some asshole who you don't even like donating to your campaign, and then you're like, oh god, I gotta talk to this fucker.
I gotta go kiss his ass.
You know, or not kiss his ass, but you're just like, man, I even like that guy. Now I see him, I feel like he's helped me out, and I feel like in debt to him or something. And also, you know, you have friends who you know have less money than you that are giving you their money, and like that's really hard to take. You know, I have one of my students like gave me money, and I know he has no money, and it's just like, man, it's just heartbreaking. Yeah. You feel like an asshole.
And he just scraped together like 10, 15, like 25 bucks. Or,
but it's like $20 he doesn't have, you know? So those situations are really uncomfortable.
They say it's not going to be viable for long because it's just, I mean, how many people can you hit up after a while? And if things don't, you know, like hit the public, a broader public or whatever the fuck, like the larger public, and actually like take off on their own. I mean, you are literally hassling the same people again and again. So, I mean,
and all the people you know with money don't give you shit.
It's true.
That
the rich have a tight.
The wallets are tight. Yeah,
this is how they stay rich, I guess.
I guess so.
But on the other hand, though, is that emboldening at all? I mean, that's got to make you feel good in a way, because you know, you say, I have this idea, we want to do this movie, and people go, fuck, I don't have any money, but I love the art you guys do, so here's fuck what I got.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
no, insanely grateful.
Yeah, it's flattering, it's nice, but it's still, you know, very awkward in its own kind of way. But
does the weight of expectation, does that weigh on you? I mean, is that a no?
No. I mean, you kind of know, I mean, I think people know the kind of films that Nathan and I make, and like, you know, some are going to like it, some are going to hate it. And at this point, I think we're both comfortable with that.
I asked an artist. I interviewed David Beck, who has a film here. It's called Curious World. I said, you know, what's next for you? And he's sort of at the end of his career. And he said, as long as I can keep making art, then I'll be successful. He's like, fuck, I'm old, though. So as long as I can keep doing this. You know, you guys talked about sort of Kickstarter not necessarily being sustainable. How do you keep doing what you do then? Like, what are the avenues for independent film compared to what it was 5 years ago?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Mike and I, like, a perfect example is last year here, a movie came together within a few days just because we got, like, deliriously excited about this idea. And then we were chasing everyone down and getting them involved. And then something similar happened in Vienna 2 weeks ago. Mike and I came up with this other idea, and now we're getting it all, we're putting it together. I mean, so you just, as soon as you're after an idea, you find a way of making it happen.
Right.
I don't know how it happens or why it happens, but you're insistent enough. You have to be off a bit, but.
Yeah. I mean, I think the trick is there's no trick, like how to get money or anything. It's like, if you really want to make the film, like Nathan's saying, like you'll figure out a way to do it. And I think the problem with a lot of, I would say, independent filmmakers is they're waiting for someone to come show up with a bag of money to make this like dream script that they have, which is just not feasible. Like it doesn't happen like that anymore. So you have to be like crazy and insane and be annoying and like somehow.
We literally within 5 days of being here, we had a movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's fucking badass though, because holy shit.
I like that. See, things like that just
occur. Yeah, that was great.
And then you incorporate that.
That's how you know. That's how you know it's live, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, I really don't edit this very much. What you're describing though reminds me sort of a punk rock aesthetic, because I grew up loving punk rock, and that sort of informed what I do. It's why I started my own podcast.
Yeah.
It's like when you see people getting opportunities, you think there's like turns, right? Where it's like, okay, it was their turn, now it's their turn, now it's their turn. It doesn't work that way at all. No. Like, you got to make it happen. And however that comes together, it's one of the things that comes up again and again on this podcast. So while it's fucking terrifying, it's awesome to hear you guys describe it that way.
I mean, it's the only way we know how,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's it. Yeah, I mean,
we haven't had, like, box office success. So no one has any expectations.
Yeah.
Except from...
Expectations are very low.
Which is great. That's the way it should be, though. I mean, if Hell expectations were high, what would we do with ourselves?
Yeah.
When I started asking people to be on this show, I had nothing to show them, right?
Yeah.
And that's always a weird ask. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, would you come be on my show and talk about your job? And they go, why do you want to talk about my job, number one? And you go, okay, the fucking false humility that everyone carries with them is charming, but sort of overdone. And secondly, I don't have anything to show you. And you're asking people to make a leap of faith. And the leap of faith of making a film, because how long did it take to make, like, Lancaster? How long did it take to make Stinking Heaven?
I mean, we shot Singing Heaven in 13 days and then 2 days of pickups.
Wow. Okay. So,
but then you edited for how long?
We edited for, we were editing while we were shooting, and then we started shooting in August, and then we had it completed by January.
Okay. Okay. And what about California Dreams?
I mean, California Dreams, we're still shooting. We get a little bit of money. We shoot for 2 days. Mm. We're editing while we go.
Okay.
So it's been going on now for maybe like a year, but we've only shot, I think, 10 days total throughout the year.
Yeah. And the reason I bring that up is because when I ask people to be on the podcast, you know, it's like, hey, can you give me an hour? Mm. You know, you guys are, it's weeks out of people's lives.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Is it sort of a leap of faith at that point? Or is it? Do you just find people who love the art and go, I love your vision, I love the idea, fuck it, let's do it. I mean,
well, I think, you know, I mean, I didn't know Nate when he made his first movie, and he didn't know me, and I think we both made our first movie the same way. Like, we had like this huge crew, and it was like more money, and we like thought to make a movie, you had to do it in this kind of like cliche way of how a Hollywood film would be made with all these crew members and like
craft services.
Yeah. You know, my shoot was miserable and terrible. And after I finished that, I said, I'm never making a movie like that again. And I think, you know, the Denver movie, we had a super small crew. Our DP ended up becoming one of our really close friends. And like, I think on everything I make, it's like a very small crew with just my friends. And that's the only way I really want to continue to make films, because life is too short to work with people you don't like.
I mean, you're literally with these people all the time. I mean, it's like, that is your life. It's not like you have a life outside of that. It's not, you know.
When you say a small crew, how small is a small crew?
You're like 10 or...
Denver was like 10 people,
yeah,
maybe.
10 people.
Wow.
I mean, California Dreams, most of the times it's me, the DP, the sound person, and maybe like a 5-person crew.
Okay.
I don't know what was Stinking Heaven.
Stinking Heaven was like, it was like 10 people.
Yeah.
Filming that movie on Betamax, as you did. Right, it was Betamax.
My producer will correct me. It was like a 3/4 inch. I don't know what the hell it is. It's a, okay. It's an Ikigami. It's an old broadcast camera. It's a tube camera. It's analog video.
Okay.
And
did you have to edit it that way? Did you have to do like analog with like the knife?
No. We basically were recording onto a hard drive, so we had an analog to digital converter.
Okay.
And so we'd get the footage back. I mean, it was on a hard drive, and we just then throw it onto another one and start editing.
So it's kind of a cool, like, lo-fi meets current technology kind of situation.
Yeah.
That's awesome. What has the reception been so far?
To Singing Heaven?
Yeah.
It's been well-received in every place except for Paris.
Okay.
It was hated in Paris. I don't know why. But just, like, literally, they got hate mail. The festival that screened it, people were tweeting critics to like, write pieces about me, how I shouldn't make movies anymore.
Oh. How's that feel?
Oh, I mean, I love that. I mean, that's great to get a reaction. It's
it's better than people going meh, right?
I guess,
of course.
But I mean, well received by a small community of people. It's like cinephiles, and it's not going to please mass audience, you know. And I understand that it wasn't made for one.
Yeah, no, certainly not. Mike, reactions to Lancaster?
I mean, it's been good. I mean, it's hard to say. Like, mostly when people don't like your movie, they don't come up and tell you, you know.
Right.
It's been fine.
You haven't inspired any hate mail.
No, I mean, the Q&A at AFI last week, some guy talked to him in the hallway, and he told me how much he liked the movie. Then he came into the Q&A and acted as though we hadn't just talked, and he asked a question like a stranger, and he was basically like, why did you make this? Why are you exploiting Corey? Why do you think it's okay to show this moment to other people? And like really angry.
Yeah.
And he said that he wanted to punch the guy in the face, the other guy in the car interviewing him.
Okay.
That was a nice one. Just a little moment of tension.
Dying.
Was he posturing or what?
I don't know. I mean, it was just very bizarre because we had just talked in the hallway. And he was like, hey, bro, how's it going, man? I love the movie. And then he came in and he like put on this like facade and like.
And just pulled out his daggers.
Right? Yeah. Which is fine, you know. I mean, I've had that a few times at Q&As, which is much more interesting than, like, what camera did you use, you know?
Right. Other aspiring directors and, like, film dorks.
What was the budget, you know? I mean,
right. Gives a shit what the budget was. But, I mean, is some of that, when you go to film festivals, is some of that, like, intelligence gathering from people who are less experienced, do you think?
When they're asking questions.
Yeah. The questions like, what was the budget? What camera did you use? Do you think they're going, okay, here's a guy who made something successful. and is showing it at a festival, how do I do that? You know, what equipment haven't I considered? That kind of thing.
I mean, maybe. I just think it's such a dumb question because it's so relative to, like, what you're making and, like, where you were and, like, the circumstances when you made it. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, asking someone, how much you make this for? And they say $50,000. Like, okay, great. I mean, how does that relate to, like, the project that this person wants to do?
Right.
You know, every film's different. And it's just all... I think sometimes people don't know what to ask and they feel like that's...
Right.
I know. I find Q&A is very strange, and particularly when you go from country to country. In some countries, the audience has they refuse to ask a question. Like, you'll just be like, yeah. I'm here, flew across the sea to be here to present this movie, and no one has anything to ask me. It's just amazing. So you're just kind of going at it with a moderator. And I think it's because I think festivals do it. It's a strategic thing to attract more audience, you know?
Right.
So I don't necessarily... know that it gives the audience anything. I don't stay for Q&As at movies. I fucking hate.
Yeah, every once in a while I will if it's like...
If it's a fun... if it's like a bizarre person or...
But, you know, I was doing the Q&A with... It was in the shorts program, so there's all these other guys up there with me. And, I mean, I hate to say it, but they were just, like, so boring. And if I was in that audience, I would have left. Like, some people just talking about their influences and just boring everyone. Like, no one cares. Like, so go up there and be funny or be evasive or fuck around. But, like, going up there and just talking about, like, your process as though anyone knows who you are or cares what your process is.
Right.
You know, you can talk about your process once you have a catalog of work, you know. Made one fucking 5-minute short film. You're like, you don't have a process.
You're not David fucking Fincher.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, I don't like listening to him. He's boring.
Yeah, he's boring as shit.
I've never heard him,
but that's like,
speak.
Like someone like Werner Herzog's interesting to listen to.
Yeah,
because he's telling bullshit all the time. He's just spinning bullshit.
And same with like someone like Altman, who was like always lying when he's talking about his movies, and so you never know like what's true and what's false, and like that's so much more interesting than like someone, you know, acting as though an expert on cinema.
Or like Tarantino talking about like these Chinese kung fu movies you've never heard of, like from the 1970s, and I don't know why. I could listen to him talk about that all day.
He's excited. He's like got an excited
passion.
He's such a strange dude.
Cokehead voice.
I read an interview with Zoe Bell, who's here, and she said Tarantino was a huge fan of the show Moesha.
Okay.
That was like on the WB in the 90s who was that, Brandy, I think.
Yeah.
And I would listen to Tarantino talk about Moesha. Listening to someone who's made their first 5-minute feature talk about their process.
Sure.
That sounds like worse than death.
Yeah.
Like, what you're describing.
Really bad.
So that's what a festival is, though.
Yeah,
he's listening to that.
Listening to people sort of sniff their own farts, right?
Yeah, and people coming up and giving you their fucking dumb business card and like their stupid flyer for the movie that you're not going to see. Like, it just I'm just so fed up with it. Me and Nate don't want to talk to anyone anymore. We decided
we hide away. We hide in the corner.
Well, thanks for being on this show.
No, but we should. Like, I'm talking about like when you talk to some guy and he's like, "Hey, give you his business card. Like, let's keep in touch." It's like, keep in touch. I just met you. Like, what am I keeping in touch about? I don't like talking to you now. I don't want to send an email to you afterwards.
Yeah.
The beauty of all this though is that Mike and I actually met at a festival. That's like in that. It's, and I've met really good friends.
We met Henning now, but I mean, you meet people and you either like instantly like them and you connect,
or it's like the jerks would like they'll throw cars at you. They literally. Like,
I had some asshole at the last festival who gave me his fucking business card like 5 times, and I said, "If you give me your fucking card one more time, man, like I'm gonna shove it down your throat. Like, why are you keep giving it to me? And the fact you don't remember that you're giving it to me like shows what an asshole you are."
And shows how irrelevant I actually am to you.
Yeah, exactly. You obviously do not care. You haven't remembered the last 4 times.
That's
embarrassing.
That's bad festival behavior.
Mm-hmm. Or just a bad human being.
Bad human being, exactly.
Yeah. Festivals like this, I'm sure you just get people selling you all the time. Not looking to connect, not looking to actually learn anything about you, but how can you help me?
Sure.
Right? Is that what you're describing?
I don't actually know what it is because I can't help anyone. You know what I mean?
Right.
I can barely like, feed myself. I can't help you get your movie made. Like, I don't know anyone. If I did, I wouldn't tell you anyways. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what they're looking for. And so it's some bizarre, I don't know what it is. Like, people just going
people
through
want
some
answers.
Kind of,
one quick,
yeah, like there's,
quick and easy.
Yeah, the quick, solution. Easy way to be, like, rich and famous. It's like, well, listen, I'm neither, so I don't know why you're asking me about that stuff.
Is that paradoxical, though? Because a movie, like the movies that you guys make, probably not suited for wide theatrical studio releases, right? Mm-hmm.
Of course,
So it's festivals, or like, what are the alternative means of getting people to see it? Because presumably you make this stuff so other people can see it, right?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, it ends up, I'll play a few cities, like it'll open in a few cities, get reviews, and then it lives online, VOD, sold abroad to TV, a bunch of TV stations abroad.
Really?
Yep.
So if you were vacationing somewhere,
if you were, say, you were in Belgium or France,
right?
It would be on certain terms would come up dubbed.
Wow.
Yep.
That's cool. They dubbed it.
Yeah, they're dubbing
wow,
it.
Wow, that's cool.
Wow. Is that weird to watch it like that?
I haven't seen the dubbed version yet. Okay. I think it'll be a lot better than the original, though. That's why I can't wait to watch it.
So in Paris, was it dubbed or was it shown in English?
Oh no! Whenever my movies screen there, they're shown in English with subtitles. But when you sell them to TV stations, for whatever reason, they still do dubbing.
Wow, I watched The Simpsons once in Spain, and the voices were all different. Mm. Totally fucked me up. A property like The Simpsons, though.
Yeah, I know.
The voices are sort of really important.
Absolutely.
And so when they're different, you go, what the hell am I watching?
Well, our German friend Henning was just talking about how he grew up on Humphrey Bogart with, the German actor who dubbed him.
The voice,
with that voice. And so he didn't realize what Bogart was until he saw, the English version. He's like, this is not Bogart.
Yeah.
The real Bogart is not Bogart.
Jesus. I feel like we're talking about, simulacra and simulation or something. Couple of prosaic questions for you guys, just because I'm always curious about this. Why, what got you into making movies? What made you go, I want to do this for a living? This is my art. This is what I want to pursue. Mm. What was the path like for you guys?
For me, I went from being a poet to a playwright to doing movies, and it was just circumstantial, I suppose.
Delve into that a little bit for me.
I wanted to stop being holed up in my room writing, and I wanted to be around people because I think I wouldn't be social otherwise.
Interesting. Yeah. And I believe me, I get the impulse.
Yeah. Movies are basically the only reason I speak to people.
Fair enough. Mike?
I went to junior college. I didn't really know what I was going to do with my life. I was kind of lost. And I moved back home after a few years, and I took a Super 8 filmmaking class, and I guess it was the first thing I ever did where I didn't feel terrible at it. You know, I felt
you had a touch for it.
Or I didn't, I would say a touch, but I wasn't struggling through what I was with everything else. And so, I kind of randomly applied to art schools to see if I could get in, and I got in, and then here I am. But it wasn't I grew up wanting to be a director, watching movies and saying that's what I want to do with my life. It just kind of happened.
Same thing for me, but I know a lot of people where that was the case, really. Mm-hmm. And it's a funny thing because I just don't connect with that.
Yeah, not at all.
Something you'll read probably if you read film criticism or you're interested in film at all is people decrying the death of art house. I think I've read a piece like that probably at least twice a year since 1995. What do you guys see as the future of independent cinema with the proliferation of the internet, video on demand, that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Does that make it easier or does it make it harder with a fractured audience?
I think we're living with a fractured audience. I don't know.
I mean, I think it's easier in the sense that anyone can go make a movie now. If it was the early 90s, right? Linkletter and all those guys came up, you had to have 16mm and all this stuff. So you can make a movie much easier, but I think there's a heap more of just shit out there for people to get through to actually find anything good. So in a way, it's easier. In a way, I think it's a lot harder because there's so much crap to try to find something interesting. I mean, go in your Netflix queue and things that they're referring to. All these movies, I try to watch them, and they're just unfucking watchable.
Yeah.
They're terrible.
Well, and who has fucking time for all that?
I know. I mean, who has time? So, again, to get your movie out there for people to find it, I think in a way it's kind of more difficult now.
But it's kind of a blessing that I think both of us came about in a time when it was already fractured. It was already on the decline. So we didn't have these expectations where we thought we needed a certain amount of money and a certain amount of power to get our stuff out there. So we have that going for us, even if we have no audience.
Yeah.
In that type of environment, how do you guys define success then? What would you define as the ultimate success for Stinking Heaven?
Oh, I think it had to. We sold it in the U.S., which I haven't done with any of my movies. We've had releases, but we've never actually sold it to a company, and we sold it in the U.S., which I think a movie that we were shot an analog video that is not welcoming in the least.
Right.
That's success for me.
Totally.
Not just because with other movies, I've sold them abroad, but this I can say I sold this one in the U.S. and got money for it.
That's awesome. I think that's a great definition of success. You make something, someone else goes, you know what? I want to pay for this.
But also just that a movie that's that uninviting would sell.
Yeah,
out of all my other movies, it's the least inviting, and I like the fact that that's the one that sells, you know? And we sold it in Rotterdam when we were in the Netherlands, not even when I was in the U.S. Yeah.
That's badass, man.
You can ask my mother. Most of the time I call up and I'm miserable and she's like, oh, you're running up here and here. And I'm like, that's like success for me. I mean, it's just like trying to just move forward with projects and not go insane. That's success, I guess.
Totally. Mike, how do you define it?
I don't know. I mean, because I feel like maybe the films that I've made that are less successful, I like more than the ones that would be considered a success, which I don't know. Success is like such an arbitrary thing. Like, you could make a movie and sell it for a bunch of money, and it doesn't mean like you would be happy with the movie, you know? So I think success for me might just be like being excited about the things that I get to make, the movies that I want to make. I mean, the fact that we could make a movie like the Denver movie is insane.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because, you know, it's not a movie you could go pitch to someone or give them, like, a log line. So in a way, I think, like, that to me is really successful that we, like, had an idea and within a year we got to make this movie. And, I mean, if people like it or hate it, you know, I don't know if either one will mean that it's a successful project. You know?
Right. I think that's fair. I mean,
thank you so much. Can I get
We're getting more drinks here, so this is fantastic.
Booze are flowing.
This is the turn in the podcast. This is where it gets really good. Yeah, fuck it. What are you drinking?
I'm drinking whiskey and water.
I'll take a whiskey rocks.
Great.
Hell yeah. Let's do it.
been down this hole before.
Yeah. We're going 3 hours, Pete Holmes.
That's great.
No, I'm kidding. When I wrote a daily humor, like I wrote a comedy blog for a long time, I had one article that kind of went viral. And it was some stupid piece of shit I wrote just making fun of people who own Jeep Wranglers, which was a piece that I wrote. It's like Lorne Michaels says about Saturday Night Live. The show doesn't go on because it's ready. It goes on because it's 11:30 on Saturday, right? Mm-hmm. So I wrote this thing. It took on a life of its own. And I go, why did this fucking one have to be? Like, why was it this one? Because I don't even like this piece that much. And it's still getting comments to this day. I wrote the thing 4 years ago.
Wow.
So when you talk about success, it's actually in a weird way refreshing to hear you describe it that way, because I don't know how I define success with that site. So when I've talked to so many artists here, and everyone has a different definition, and what it mostly comes down to is getting to work on the things that you want to work on.
Yeah.
And so, I mean...
Well, that's the dream, you know? I mean, I think we both know people that are making much more money than Nathan and I and making stuff much bigger that actually they're like super miserable because at the end of the day, like if you have to go make a movie where you don't like the script, you don't like the people you're working with, you might as well be working at Starbucks.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like that's not something, I think when you get out of film school, like that's what you think you have to aspire to do. Mm. Like you have to get a studio job and make some movie with a bunch of money. But I don't think that's the dream.
No, true. But I mean, we do all have bills to pay. So I mean, do you guys ever take on like for hire type stuff?
I mean, we'll do anything for money.
Yeah, of course. I mean, but I usually outside of film, like doing PowerPoint and other stuff.
Yeah, I gotcha.
I would never want to do PA work or anything. Like
I never want to work on a movie.
I hate being on film sets. They're not my own. Like yeah. I like to act in films, but like I fucking hate film sets. Are awful.
Yeah.
So okay, that is a worthwhile topic of discussion that I'm interested in, because most people think movies. They think going to the movies, right? And they picture, you know, they picture Hollywood. What makes film sets so miserable?
Any movie where you're getting paid to do grunt work on a film, it's probably going to be a miserable experience. It's just labor, and it makes you hate the act of making a film that much more. I just can't stand it. I don't learn anything from it, and I don't meet any people because I'm so miserable. I look like, you know, Travis Bickle the whole fucking time. So I'd rather do a job where I'm away from film and make money that way than do a job where I'm associated. Because, like, I don't have any skills. I'm not a cameraman. I'm not going to be in any place where I have any sort of creative input whatsoever. Maybe writing, helping with, you know, writing.
Sure. But, I mean, that's not really an on-set kind of job.
It's not an on-set job, yeah.
You know, it's funny because if you want to de-glamorize something that you thought you loved, like, go do it for hire. Yeah. I thought I wanted to be a... concert promoter when I was in college. I worked at my radio station, put on a concert, dealt with bands, fucking hated it. Yeah. And I go, I'm never doing this again. You're dealing with bands. Bands are infantile. Club owners are fucking crooks.
Yeah.
Like bartenders are trying to skim money from you.
Yeah.
It sucks. Yeah, it's funny hearing you describe a film set that way.
Well, I mean, a film set where you're going to make
not
money.
Like that,
yeah. I mean, like, I think like the Denver film, like the set on the Denver film was fun. We just were drinking every day, and
yeah. I mean, I remember the crew a couple times. One night, the two of the guys, they were local guys. We were all out drinking. It was like the fourth or fifth day into the shoot. And they were like pretty serious dudes, you know. Mm-hmm. And they work on like real productions and stuff. And we were out in our backyard drinking. And they were like, hey, man, can we tell you something? And I was like, fuck, here it comes. You know
what I mean? You're like, what?
Like, what are they going to say? And they were like, this has been the funnest experience of our life. We don't want this film to end. We've never had more fun on the set. And to me, like, that was the biggest compliment.
Dude, that's, you know, a huge endorsement.
I mean, it's great. Yeah. But, I mean, just also because we were, like, getting drunk on set and smoking weed. And
it was a fun time.
It was fun. It was actually fun, yeah.
I've got to find out what this movie is about.
It's about that. There's a lot of that in the movie.
Okay. Well, I think you picked the right city for it.
Yeah. We came here in the city. They basically, Denver directed the movie. We had nothing to do with it.
It's true.
I live here. Is there any chance I'm in it?
I don't know. You hang out at Knob Hill?
Not regularly, but yeah. I've been there.
Well, we shot there a lot.
All right.
That place.
We drank at the PS Lounge a bunch every night.
Oh, the PS Lounge.
Oh, what a great place.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you get pizza from Enzo's?
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
And our DP did push-ups on the bar.
Our DP lit a cigarette in PS Lounge. He did push-ups on the bar. He told the bartender he wanted an analyzer. It's a mystery that we were able to come back every night.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I mean, they give you a free shot with every... Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which...
And a rose for the women, yeah.
Yeah. That place is weird, man. I love that place. Mm-hmm. All right. So what's next for you guys? You mentioned that you've sold Stinking Heaven. You're screening it here?
Yep. And it's going to open in the States in December in a few cities.
Nice. Is there a wide release, or is it just a few cities?
It's just a few cities.
Is Denver one of them?
My distributor's talking to the C. We'll see.
Okay. Yeah, I gotcha. And what about you? What's next for California Dreams?
I'm just trying to finish it, you know.
Close?
I think we're close, yeah. And then, you know, me and Nate are finishing the Denver movie. And then we're going to try to shoot this film in Berlin in the summer. Nice. So we'll see if that
You guys happens. Are working together again?
Yeah.
Nice. We want to do a trilogy.
Yeah, we want to do a trilogy about drivers at festivals.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. Yeah. So right now is the time in the show where you guys plug whatever you want. Plug the films, plug your websites.
Unfortunately, Mike and I can't plug anything.
Yeah. We don't do any plugging.
No?
We're turned off.
Okay.
Buy us a drink at Knob Hill. If we can plug that, that'd be great.
Yeah, all right.
Knob Hill's a great bar. We'll plug that.
Yeah, we'll go to Knob Hill, go to PS Lounge.
There'll be a photo of the three of us. Mm-hmm. So the plug is, if you see us at Knob Hill or PS Lounge, buy any one of the three
or
of us.
Or anywhere in Denver, buy us a drink.
Yeah, totally.
That's all we want.
That's a really good plug. So no Twitter, no websites, nothing?
We don't have any of that shit.
You guys are purists. I fucking love you.
Hey. It's not out of purity. It's out of just self-hatred.
Don't know what we're doing.
Well, whatever the case, this is the quickest that this part of the show has ever gone.
You always have to ask, what would G.G. Allen do? He wouldn't plug shit.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
G.G. Allen would just cut himself up a little bit more.
Yeah, exactly.
So, feel free to flagellate yourselves a little more. We'll drink. Thanks for being on the show, guys.
Of course, thank you for having us, man.
Yeah, this was a real pleasure, and best of luck to you guys.
Cool. Thanks, man. Thank you.
That's it for episode 82 of the John of All Trades podcast. Thank you to Nate Silver and Mike Ott for taking the time and telling me a little bit about what they do. I appreciated their insight, I appreciated their candor, and I cannot wait to find out more about the Untitled Denver project. So, hopefully we can talk about that next year. Since they're not plugging anything, I will plug myself here. John of All Trades is on John of All Trades, that's J-O-N, of All Trades.us. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, you can find us there. It's J-O-A-T pod for both. We're on iTunes. We're on Stitcher. Just search John of All Trades. And while you're there, hey, you know what? Give us a review. Give us a rating. One of the things that Nate talked about was, hey, you get your project out there, get it reviewed. Hopefully people come to it. Same deal with iTunes and Stitcher. So if you're listening to us on either one of those services, take the time, give us a rating, give us a review. I appreciate it very much. This is a production of Deft Communications, Denver-based content, strategy, and engagement. Hit us up on the web, deftcom.us. We do all sorts of different types of projects, so a lot to learn there. We got one more. It's coming up tomorrow. That'll air Wednesday. It's a big one, too. I think you'll really enjoy who it is. So we'll wrap up our Denver Film Festival coverage then. Until I see you, say goodnight, Grayson.